So we'd like to welcome Dharma teacher Alan Richardson to the Ango today. Alan is one of the leaders at Hank and Newton, and a longtime practitioner, started as a young man and then wised up and left Zen, but then fell off and re-entered Zen now quite a few years ago, a longtime member of Boundless Way. Lovely to have you.
Thank you, David. It's lovely to be here this morning. And really, I had wanted to come still earlier and join the 6 a.m. sit. Really? And I thought about it, but I decided not to, and chose instead to walk my girlfriend's son to school, as I usually do, especially because I'd been traveling and we'd miss a few walks. And that has something to do with what I wanted us to talk about today. When Shakyamuni Buddha rose up from underneath the Bodhi tree after his great experience of awakening, he didn't go home to his wife and his son and his parents, assuming they were still living. He stayed more or less where he was, and he began the first Sangha with his companions from his ascetic days. And they began a life that was outdoors a lot of the time, but still somewhat monastic. And ever since then, Buddhism has often had a strongly monastic flavor. There's often been a sense that the real practitioner is the one who leaves his family and goes to the monastery or goes to the forest sanctuary. And the lay practitioners are okay for supporting those monasteries and giving gifts. And maybe in another life, they too can become monks and do the real deal. And sometimes I find this attitude in Dogen, and I've talked about this before, I think in question periods at the Sesshin, some of those moments in Dogen trouble me. Because it seems at times he advises people rather harshly to turn their backs on those who depend on them and those who they love. So I was really struck in this text that we're reading during Ango, the Bodhisattva's Four Methods of Guidance, that Dogen here seems to reach out to those of us who are not monastics and probably never will be, however attractive we might have been at one time to that kind of life. And there are two moments in the giving section, which Steve led us in reading today, that I was especially struck by. And I'll start with the second one. Buddha said, "If you were to practice giving to yourself, how much more to your parents, wife, and children? Therefore, you should know that to give to yourself is a part of giving. To give to your family is also giving." And then a little before that, something that doesn't at first seem related, but I think is, if you study giving closely, you see that to accept a body and to give up the body are both giving. So, I think when we read the part about giving up the body, that's easy for us. Many of us grew up in a dominant Christian culture that has a rather dualistic view of the body and life. Life is the crappy part. The afterlife is the good part. Life is the veil of tears. The body is a burden. We're here to endure and suffer and undergo and purify ourselves for a disembodied life later on. And that, of course, is not what Buddhism teaches. So if we read to give up the body as giving in that way, then I think we're falling into old patterns that many of us may have spent years trying to get free of. To accept the body, very rare to find that, I think, in the dualistic religions. To accept the body gets us, I think, to the heart of Buddhist teachings. We don't despise our bodies. We don't wish that we could somehow become disembodied spirits. We don't look forward to a time when we will be disembodied spirits. We are taught that our practice is through the body, and that we are not trying to get beyond the body, but we're trying to get to a life of being entirely in and with the body, not separating, not floating off from this body, from this moment, from this breath, from this place. So I think that giving to our partners and giving to our families involves this acceptance of a body that Dogen talks about here. It might seem that giving to our spouses, our partners, our families is the easy part, and giving to strangers is the hard part. Again, growing up in a Christian culture, we think about love thine enemy, that's the hard lesson. But in my experience, it's not so easy to really give to the people that you're closest to. We can, you know, give them gifts and cash and our time, but to really give ourselves to them, that I think is really difficult. Because it's our partner, our beloved, it's our child who can really make us feel vulnerable and really make us want to close in subtle and not so subtle ways. To want to shut down, to give with that hand that's not really giving, to accept in a way that says, you know, I don't need this. And yet, when we turn away or turn within in those ways that come so naturally to us or seem to, I think it's a way of not accepting our bodies, of not accepting the intimacy that comes with embodied life, of not accepting the loss of self-other differences that comes with really being there with our partners, with our kids, really letting ourselves give to them by opening up to them, by not closing down. By being willing to accept all the pain that may come with that openness, that accepting a body entails. So I'm very grateful to the Bodhisattva guidance text that we're reading, because it enables me to see that Dogen, in fact, all those centuries ago, was indeed imagining a bodhisattva way that was open to those of us who have jobs and who have aging or dying parents and who have lovers, who may have children, who may be raising other people's children, who have siblings. All these open to us so many more doors to giving. All these can inspire us with truly accepting this body, this life, this heart. So Buddha said, if you were to practice giving to yourself, how much more so to your parents, wife, and children? Therefore, you should know that to give to yourself is a part of giving. To give to your family is also giving.
Thank you.
So please make yourselves comfortable for our Dharma dialogue. And we'll go around and say our names. I'm Melissa.
Steve.
Fran.
Ed. Wayne.
Michael.
Diane.
Jesse.
David.
Al.
Yeah, Ed.
Alan, it's great to see you. That's, I guess, my first gift today.
Thank you. It is gratefully accepted.
I think my wife would agree with you that at least as far as I'm concerned, that giving in the sense of opening up is extremely difficult, at least certainly for me. But I think even more than that, and it's one of these things that is hitting me more and more through this anga, that gift that you give to yourself, that opening up, that acceptance is even harder.
Yeah.
So thank you for bringing that up and making it alive for me.
Thank you, Ed. And it's wonderful to know that it will only get harder.
And I also loved your talking about giving as not shutting down, you know, so not shutting down to the people in our lives and just not shutting down, you know, like every moment presents itself, and instead of this, you know, Dogen's, you know, all the things come and confirm the self, and allowing that to happen. It's such a such a basic part of our practice that, you know, that we just continually need to work with. So it made this passage for me alive in that way that I hadn't quite seen before. So thank you.
Well, and I think the subtlety of that, of the heart opening and closing, mm-hmm. you know, because we can be civil with our family, and with a totally closed heart, you know, we can be a million miles away, and with ourselves too. Oh yeah, I'll keep practicing, and I'm gone. So quite an impact, I think, whether our hearts open, close, not just on our partners but on the world. Mm. You know, the what was that last night? The part about the, you know, when a person walks in the room who's practicing giving, there's something that is either some permission to show up or some, well, if you know, if he's closed down, I better close down too. But this whole thing too of strangers and family and how the stakes are so much higher and so much harder with people we know better.
That's an interesting thing, because have you ever noticed how sometimes, you know, it's not that common for me, but once in a while you'll encounter somebody that you don't really know all that well, and just, you know, you just will say stuff to them that, you know, you couldn't say to those that are closest to you easily, you know, because it counts so much, you know, what they think of you and their reaction and everything, and you have to, you know, kind of, you know, be aware of that, and with somebody you don't really know that well, you can come right out and say, you know, this is how I feel, you know, like it or no, this is how it is, you know, and I really appreciated, Alan, you bringing out the thing about the whole monastic thing, and that's very interesting to hear he is talking about, you know, how we relate to family, mm-hmm. and he mentions, you know, work, you know, productive work, and, you know, it all could be very directly applied to the life of a householder, and I hadn't really noticed that until you mentioned it. Thank you.
Yeah, most of Dogen's writing, my understanding, it was written for his monks. Mm-hmm. And this was intentionally written for his lay practitioners. Mm-hmm. So you can kind of feel the difference. I think it's one of the reasons why the teachers picked it, because it's just so relatable in some ways that some of the other texts aren't. Guidelines for how to sit in the hall, for how to wash your hands, go to the back, you know. They're very specifically oriented for a particular audience.
David mentioned that I began my Buddhist practice at a tender age, just 17, and when I was 18 I went to the San Francisco Zen Center because I really wanted that monastic kind of life. I thought that that would be my life. I was convinced of it. And I had applied to do a sesshin at Tassajara, which I was turned down for. And I was turned down for it after I had an interview with Richard Baker Roshi, who had only recently become the Roshi. He'd only been the master there for a couple of years. But I really looked up to him, and so I was probably pretty terrified to have this one and only interview I ever had with him. And he said to me, he was asking me why I was there and what I was doing, and I, you know, said the usual, I'm here to save all sentient beings. And he said to me, well, you know, while you're 18, don't you think you should go out to some parties with some other people? And I thought, what is he talking about? And now, you know, what, 40 years later, I think I'm starting to understand why he said that.
Mm-hmm. To go to a lot of parties.
Did you?
But this thing about the currying favor, about the response of the other people, I mean, Steve, when you, that really touches me when you say that so often we are constantly monitoring what we reveal and don't reveal based on what the other person's reaction is. Mm. So then some of that's wonderful. You know, we are in dialogue and it's something going on. But I was reading some therapist who was talking about the difficulty in any close relationship of showing up without knowing what the response is going to be. So the gift of showing up as ourself and like, well, I hope you like this, but whether you like it or not, this is what's true for me. You know, so it's not, you have to agree to like me and tell me I'm good after I tell you this, but actually, you know, this is how it is for me. And the courage to do that. And I think that's this giving, this non-greed, not measuring everything as a manipulation or waiting, not waiting until it's safe.
There's it reminded me when you said this, there's a remarkable video online by sociologists, I think, Bernie Brown, called The Power of Vulnerability.
I saw that, oh my goodness.
It's incredible how she opens up, I recommend if anybody just Googling it and finding it, how to live, or she analyzed how living wholeheartedly and opening up, regardless of what the impact is from other people, alters and transforms you. Essentially, and the people who, there's all sorts of statistics behind this, but you know, the life, your life changes significantly by living vulnerable, and there's huge power in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's a vulnerability researcher. Yeah, I mean, this is what she does. I think that's true.
Yeah,
so amazing. Well, I was thinking too about what you were saying, Steve, in this little track that we're on right now. That what we've been talking about, the construction of the self, and how, you know, we carefully construct a self from the very, very early days of our lives and maintain it. When you're with a new person, you could allow that self to drop, because there aren't consequences. And if you're really engaged in vulnerability practice, the two of you kind of resonate together. It's like when Dogen quotes the Buddha saying, you know, the person who goes into the assembly and has this feeling of giving, you resonate with them immediately. But when you're with a person you spend day after day after day with, it's much riskier to... that sort of the self, it's like being alone with yourself. It's riskier to touch that that unconstructed person. You know, with a stranger, it's like you get to experiment and goodbye.
Right.
But with the intimate partner or friend, it's just really, it could be dangerous, you know, that because you're both engaged in constructing a self together as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's great practice to have Dharma practice as this vulnerability with a partner, but really hard, like really, really hard. Which is why we practice doing it with ourselves first. I like that you brought that in too.
Yeah,
and really hard if the other person isn't engaged in the same practice.
Thank you. And harder. Thank you for saying that. Yeah. I didn't want to speak because I have one who's engaged.
Yeah. So,
those of us who don't.
But that becomes part of the practice then.
It does.
I mean, it demands a certain kind of bodhisattva activity.
Yeah.
You know,
sure.
which does not involve didacticism. You know, you can't try saying, you know, you really ought to try.
Yeah.
Well, even if you have a partner who practices, that rarely cuts it when things are on the table. Honey, don't you remember that?
Just to reassure those of you who have partners who aren't in the way with you, nobody's in the way with you.
Yeah,
but we've got our own relationship to Dharma practice, and it's really different. So any two people side by side. Because we're constructing Dharma practice too. So.
Mm-hmm.
And one is right and one is wrong. Any relationship.
And always, you know, and... It's interesting whether it really makes a difference or not, because in some way, of course it does. I mean, to have a partner who practices, there's something, you know, the gift of Melissa and I working together and doing this is, you know, feels like just an impossible treasure.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so conscious of that.
Mm-hmm.
And my experience also is, who is this strange person I'm living with who doesn't practice Dharma the true way? You know, that it can be both at the same time, incredible gratitude and respect, and still the world shifts and I am alone and no one understands, and if only someone understood, you know, so that it can be both at the same time.
Yeah.
When that feeling of basic aloneness also, that those of us who don't have partners too, who are single,
there's
you might think that, you know, having a partner is just fabulous and you get to do all this great intimacy, vulnerability work, but it begins primarily with the self. So it doesn't really matter whether you're in a relationship or out of a relationship, whether you have kids or you don't have kids. And I think that's where the overlap is between monastics and lay people. The work of understanding the self is really hard, no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, whether you're in sangha or you're in a relationship, then it gets more complicated. You add one more person into the mix, and it's really hard. And that's partly why Dokusan is such an important part of this teaching, because you're sitting with the self for long periods of time, and, you know, maybe, like, it's like, you get something clear, and then you walk into the room with another person, and it's like any relationship. Everything falls apart in the encounter, and that's really, really important.
Mm-hmm.
If you're willing to let it fall apart in the encounter.
And the negative things and the blockages and the, you know, rejections that come from the other person can be really valuable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is the Buddha appearing to us,
mm-hmm.
finding ways to free us from our own attachments.
Mm-hmm.
You get a really good sense of what your attachments are when you're in an intimate relationship, or,
mm-hmm.
you know, when there's something you can't stand at work, or, you know, just all kinds of ways,
mm-hmm.
of ways of encountering that. And then the trick is, instead of being reactive about it, to say, okay, what is this attachment? Mm-hmm. What am I clinging to so hard here that's mm-hmm. getting me so angry or so frustrated or, you know, it's making me want to leave?
Mm-hmm. I've worked with some people who have been on this place of not knowing whether they want to stay in the relationship. And as I work with them, it's so clear that the work we're doing is for ourselves. It's not whether you're in the relationship or not, it's the self that's the problem. And it'll just appear in a different way. So this work of vulnerability, this practice, then our family is whoever we come in contact with that day, and in whatever form it is.
So something that came up for me about this, okay, is it's great to have the willingness to look at, you know, how I'm showing up in the world and how, you know, my heart is closed and I'm not, you know, relating to people who are close to me in the way that I would like. And I seem to have very limited success with saying to myself, you know, you really should be more open-hearted, Steve, you know.
Say it louder.
You think that's it? That I just not saying it loud enough?
It's just a technical thing. Wait, did you have more answers?
Well, I just wanted to ask the question, you know, where does the power to actually do this come from?
Well, you know, this is a theme that we've had through many of the Anga Dharma dialogues of not creating something like vulnerability or creating open-heartedness or gratitude, we talked about the other day, but that in the practice itself, this thing rises up. It's just like the passage you read to, and it's read today from another section of Dogen, the Genjo Koan, where it's not about going out to meet the world. It's about the world coming to meet us. So the same thing is true in cultivating these qualities. We cultivate by, just like in a garden, we don't, like we were saying the other day, you don't sit in front of the flower bud and go, come on, grow, you can do this, I know you can do it. You feed it and you, you know, water it, you create the conditions for it. So it's the same thing here. Zazen creates the conditions for the growth of vulnerability, and then you can kind of encourage, when you know it, you feel the alignment with it. It also encourages compassion, wisdom. This is a mindfulness. You know, all of this is encouraged in Zazen, so you can cooperate with it rather than fight it. And that's that little bitty moment we have where we get to make a choice, teeny tiny moment. The choices go with or go away. And the going away isn't bad either.
Right.
Right? You know, sometimes we have to just say, nope,
yeah.
Shield,
right.
Wall, goodbye, I'm not doing this.
Yeah.
Right? As soon as you don't cooperate. But when you do.
It takes a lot of going away before.
I think that's right. Yeah, that's really important to say out loud. Apparent going away.
Right.
Yeah. Alan, what's your sense of that as someone who's practiced in relationships? How do we move when we're totally contracted?
You know, I probably this just happened to work because the timing was right. But I found it really helpful at one point to try Tonglen practice, and there's a really good book about that by Pema Chodron, and that whole, I forget what that book's called, but I got it from, you know, it was in the Hank, you know, circulating library. Mm. What is that book called that, where she talks about Tonglen? It may come back to me, but...
Could you email me the title of the book?
She's really helpful on that, and the Tonglen practice is, you know, just is exactly that. It's a practice in opening up and trying to break down that sense of enclosure in the self through this, you know, really simple exercise in compassion. I think I did it in a very simple way. You know, it's a breathing exercise more than anything else. But that's just one way.
Yeah, and I think there are skillful means and many different, you know, potential things, but I think at heart all of them are about moving into the moment itself and this balance of awareness, of knowing where we are and keeping our heart open to ourself. I think that's the place I would go in, and whether it's through Tonglen or through something else, how do I keep my heart open to myself in that moment so that I can be there when the next moment comes? Because that contraction, and so thinking I should be more loving is often one way of not keeping my heart open to myself. Mm-hmm. It's saying, I don't want to be here, I am bad for being here. And then I'll pull out all of my tricks. So how to avoid tricks or know when we're doing tricks and practice in this radical way. And I so appreciate what you said about, so yeah, it may be hard to be open to our partner, but compared to ourselves, you know, quite easy. And so this is the fundamental, this is the main problem, the shuso. I mean, not yet. But this is the main problem the Buddha talked about. This contraction of the heart, this hardening. So we study the hardening of the heart. We study the contraction so that we can not fight it. And the amazing thing to me is the potential for any situation to shapeshift in a heartbeat. You know, with a friend, with a parent, with a partner, with a co-worker, when it's just terrible, or with yourself on the cushion, just terrible. I am leaving this place, you know. And the whole world, it was like Christine was saying, going to work, her whole workplace transformed. And so that I think is this wonderful mystery, this ever regenerating mystery that calls us and calls us beyond any technique or any form, so we can use skillful means and, you know, by all means, whatever we can, you know, imagery and things like that. And when it comes down to it, it's all about something much more mysterious and generous.
And I just want to add, I think we have to be really careful about skillful means and upaya and techniques. David and I were lucky in the past, before we really knew who Pema Chodron was, we got to go to a workshop with her.
Oh, wow.
And we thought it would be like a dozen people.
Before she was Pema Chodron.
Before she was, well, she was, that's her name, but you know, it's like, it wasn't like, oh my God, Pema Chodron. We just thought, oh, this woman is teaching some Tibetan thing. Let's go. And there were 100 people there. We were really amazed. But she was really clear in the teaching, and I really appreciated this, about very much the same thing you were just saying, David, that Tonglen, which is exchanging self for other, is the translation, is a technique, and it's dualistic. And it means that you have to think there's an other and a self.
Yeah.
And she said, do it by all means. You know, we spent a whole weekend on it, but always nest it in a non-dual practice. Mm. You know, like Shikhan Taza, she said, begin with the non-dual and make sure you end with the non-dual, because you can get pulled away into thinking, oh, a technique, I'll do this. You know, this is exciting. There's so many techniques. And I think that it mirrors the Buddha's own journey. I love that you brought that up. Because he tried everything. He really did. In India of the time, northern India, when he was around, it was sort of like now. except there weren't books, but there were lots of spiritual teachers teaching all kinds of techniques, and he mastered them all. That's one of the things that's said about him, that he was the best student of all the techniques. And so he used them again in his teaching later, but again, like Pema Chodron, he said, be careful. You know, these are just toys, and we want to get you out of the burning house. You know, so come on out, kids, and play with the toys. But ultimately, it's not about them.
She also says, in relation to what David said, she says, you know, start where you are.
Yeah.
Don't wait for yourself to become a better person, a more compassionate person, a calmer person. Just, you know, you have to start right in that messy place that you are. And as I was listening to David, I was saying the other half of that is you've got to let the other person be exactly where they are. You know, I've had to resist the temptation of thinking, well, if you just change this much, then we could really get some place for this intimacy stuff. You know, but that's the opposite of intimacy.
That's the name of the book, by the way. Start Where You Are.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah. That is the name of the book.
That's a great name. And we do that to ourselves, too, right? I mean, that if only I fill in the blank.
Right, if I were different.
If I were different, if you were different, if this was different, then everything would be perfect. So that's the other danger of skillful means, that you can use it just to work at things, get away from them.
Let's walk in the garden.
Thank you.